Good morning. Today is February 27th, 2018, and we're at the home of Karen Parr, who is our interviewee today. We appreciate you coming and sharing your story with us and being part of the Raven Landing Resident Stories Project, as well as the Oral History Project at the university. So we're going to start with a little biological information and information about you. Can you tell us where and when you were born?
I was born in Oakland, California, and August of 1931.
And is that where you grew up and had your young?
I grew up near Oakland, and it's sort of East Bay is continuous towns, one to another.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in Albany.
Uh-huh.
Till I was about nine, and then we moved to Southern California.
Where in Southern California?
Van Nuys first, mm-hmm. and then East Los Angeles, and then Burbank.
Oh, Burbank.
All in the space of about three and a half years.
California.
Yes.
A great state.
Well, it was wartime.
I see. Okay.
We moved to Van Nuys just before the war broke out. My father got a job with Lockheed, and Lockheed was revved up to full speed and then some, getting ready for the war.
So yeah, that kind of leads into about your family. You have siblings, what's your mom and dad, grandma, grandpa? You want to talk a little bit about them?
Yeah, I had a wonderful mom and dad. I was the oldest of three. Both my grandmothers were living at the time, and my great-grandmother on my mother's side. And she and my maternal grandmother were quite close at all times. We always lived near them. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of visiting back and forth. And my paternal grandmother lived in Fresno, and I didn't know her as well, although we did visit. She died when I was about 13. And my maternal grandmother lived to age 95.
Wow.
And we got to be big buddies, uh-huh. especially after my grandfather died.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a great thing to be able to say about your life.
Yeah.
Any stories about your parents or ancestors or offspring is the question here.
That's a large question.
It is. I was going to say we need to break that down a little bit.
Well, my father's mother came from Denmark when she was 19, and she married the son of Danish immigrants. So that one side is all Danish, and they're mm-hmm. farmers. They settled in Central California, created an irrigation system of canals coming from the rivers in the Sierra and about mm-hmm. Nevada mountains. and they were generally dairy farmers. They raised hay and alfalfa and had dairy cows, which were formed the basis of the Danish Creamery Association in Fresno, which still exists.
Do you know when they immigrated?
Pretty close. It was in the late 19th century.
Yeah.
Right around the turn of the century.
Mm-hmm. The Promised Land.
Yeah.
That's beautiful farm country.
Well, my first uncles, the older uncles, my dad was one of the younger ones. There were eight kids from that marriage, and he was number five.
Wow.
number six.
Mm-hmm.
Number six. And so the early ones were born around 1888, 1890. So she must have gotten married. I could look it up, but
I'm just curious about that.
Somewhere around 1885 to 90.
Wow. So they were there a long time. Can you tell us about what brought you to Alaska?
Same as for an awful lot of women, my husband wanted to come.
Mm-hmm.
And I was open to the idea.
Were you married in California? Did you meet your husband in California?
No. he's actually my second husband. The other one is a sad story, but I met him in Germany when I was teaching school. I was about 26 years old when I met him, and I was teaching school in Bremerhaven, Germany, and he was stationed there, a widower with three half-grown kids.
Wow.
Yeah. And we got married the next year.
Mm-hmm.
So I acquired three children just like that.
How old were they?
The twin boys were 12.
Wow.
And the girl was 10. So it was a very joyous occasion.
Uh-huh, I bet it was. And so your husband Charlie.
Yes.
So you came up here with him, yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah, his when I met him, he was 3 years short of his 20-year Army obligation, and he finished the 3 years while we were still in Germany. He just stayed there. So when the 3 years was up, we were still in Germany.
I see.
And the Army, when an officer retires after 20 years, I suppose enlisted men too, they can choose where they want to live after that, and the Army will ship their goods there, pay for them to go there, mm-hmm. and ship the goods there. Once. So Charlie had always wanted to go to Alaska.
Uh-huh.
All the time he was in the Army, he'd heard stories about Alaska. And he was a scholarly type. He read everything mm-hmm. he could get his hands on in all the base libraries. And he said, you know, I've always wanted to live there. What do you think? A family council. And the kids and I looked at each other and said, well, try anything once. If we don't like it, we can always leave.
It's amazing the kids said that, because sometimes kids are awfully...
Well, these were Army kids.
Yeah, they are.
They had
been
dragged around the world a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
They had divided their time between Germany and Austria and the southern United States.
So they were up for it.
They were willing to try it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's like everybody says, we'll try it for a year.
That's right. We got here at the beginning of the worst winter in many years, 1961.
Mm-hmm. A lot of snow, cold.
It was very cold,
very
cold. It was an adventure, of course. And the kids mostly thought it was an adventure, too.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure it was.
When they grew up, they all tried elsewhere.
Uh-huh.
But they all came back.
Oh, that's a testament, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's nice. Is there anything else you want to say about what brought you here, or is that good?
Well, that's what brought me here.
Okay.
I had been living in Oregon before I went to Germany, teaching school in Oregon, and I liked it a lot. Probably would have gone back to Oregon if
mm-hmm.
I hadn't met Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
But in my mind... Alaska is a lot like Oregon,
mm-hmm.
except colder.
Right.
And it is. There are similarities.
Especially back then.
Yes, especially back then.
Frontier spirit kind of thing.
That's right, exactly.
That's right. Can you tell us what led to your career? Can you tell us what you did? I guess you've mentioned that you taught. Did you teach when you came up here also?
Yes, yeah. What led to that?
Mm-hmm.
In my day, girls didn't have many choices. And I was told, my parents didn't send me to college. They thought that I should have an ability to support myself should I need to. And they just thought it was good for general
mm-hmm.
education,
mm-hmm.
too, for women to be educated. And I'm very grateful.
I'm sure.
But my choices were quite clear to me coming up in high school. I could be a secretary,
mm-hmm.
or I could be a nurse, or I could be a teacher. And of those three choices, that was a no-brainer, because
mm-hmm.
I was a bookish kid.
Mm-hmm.
And my aunt taught, and it was a certain amount of there were a lot of indicators in the family.
Mm-hmm.
So I prepared for teaching. I didn't have much patience for the education classes at the university. So I graduated with a general degree, and because I thought I'd try teaching on an emergency certificate and see if I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
So when I finally graduated, I went to Oregon and taught at a two-room schoolhouse in the mountains where my uncle happened to be a trustee.
Uh-huh. Well, what a wonderful experience.
To see if I liked it.
Uh-huh.
And I did like it. So I went to night school and summer schools until I got another bachelor's degree in education,
mm-hmm.
which is that what they required.
Okay. And so when you came to Alaska, where did you teach?
First, I was at Maine Junior High.
Mm-hmm.
That was a high school then, what is now City Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And we lived just a block away in a little cabin owned by Mary Rogie.
Oh, yeah.
That first winter.
Uh-huh.
Remember?
Oh, sure. I know Mary.
The cabin is gone now. It's where the fire department is now.
Uh-huh.
But that was very close to Maine, so I did a lot of substituting the first year. We came in October. It was too late to get a full-time job. But I enjoyed the junior high kids, and I was able to get along with them. And so they hired me for the next year. I taught there a few years, and then I was transferred to Hunter Elementary. And after a year there, Charlie needed to go get a study for a PhD. In the meantime, when he came up, he had no college at all.
Ooh.
It came from a very poor family. And so when we got up here, he enrolled as a freshman at age 43.
Good for him.
At the university. And he had so much general knowledge and so much knowledge from the Army and from his reading that he was able to finish in 2 years.
Wow.
And by that time, he was already teaching half-time at the university. He had taught himself German, and he had been trained in Russian by the Army.
So he taught languages then?
So he taught those Russian and German.
Oh, wow.
Language and literature.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to talk to about your work? The question is, anything you'd like your descendants to know about your work?
I enjoyed it. I wasn't the best teacher in the whole world because I tend to be disorganized and I tried to cram too much into the available time all the time. But I enjoyed the kids, and I think in general they liked me. And we did a lot of fun things, and which I think taught them quite a bit, too.
Can you think of one thing you did that was really fun that you remember?
Oh, one time they had me teaching math at the junior high, which is not my subject, but it's such simple math, that 7th and 8th grade level,
sure.
It was okay. And I had them construct paper or cardboard, mostly devices for calculating.
Oh.
Some of them made a cardboard slide rule.
Uh-huh.
The more advanced ones, I explained exponential multiplication with them. And then some of them just made addition, subtraction slide rules. And they did various devices and showed them in the science fair, and they got a prize. They had a lot of fun doing that.
Wow, that's a great story. Teachers are amazing, and to do those special things really affects children.
They do. My last year was at Salch Elementary School.
Oh, really?
Long story about how I wound up down there. But I had a sixth grade with only 17 students in it and a large classroom. So we could do a lot of things. We made huge relief maps of all the continents on the floor. On pieces of plywood strewn around the floor. Every continent, a relief map. It was the beginning of computers in the schools. We had two computers in my classroom. And one of the mothers volunteered 2 days a week the whole year. An unheard of amount of volunteering.
Wow.
We're still friends, she and I. She helped monitor the computers, and she helped teach them touch typing, those who would do it. Some of the kids wouldn't do it, but you can't make them learn it. They don't want to. But we had a computer program to help touch typing, and they learned to touch type. So then they put out a newspaper, and a community newspaper for Salcha, and charged for it. So then they had to learn elementary bookkeeping.
Sure.
And a spreadsheet on the computer to keep the books. So I think that taught them a lot, and they had a lot of fun doing that.
Well, that's great. That's a great story.
And our social studies program for that year was the nations of the world. It was world geography. And so I made them passports. And when they finished one, each region or each country, they got their passport stamped with a
visa. Little travel bug there.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what your fondest memories are?
Oh, yeah. I should back up one more time on the teaching.
Sure.
Because I did a couple of things that were unusual. I got a job in the middle of that first batch of teaching before we went to Florida. I got a job for 2 years teaching on television.
Oh, wow.
It was a federal program, a demonstration project, and they wanted me to teach modern math. At the time, that was brand new, and the teachers didn't have time to take a lesson in it. They were supposed to get training for it. But the flood hit that year, and it destroyed all the math books. And so they had to buy new math books, and so they bought the modern ones instead of the older ones, because that's what they adopted for the future year. But the teachers did not get their training, so they were kind of at a loss. So they thought if I would do a demonstration on television, how to teach it, it would help the teachers as well as the kids. And it was one of the most fun things I ever did in my whole life.
Wow, what an adventure.
It was.
I planned the whole thing?
They got me I was allowed to plan the whole thing. I had 3 lessons a week for 20 minutes each, and it was live television.
And was it broadcast? Or?
Yes, broadcast.
Wow.
This is the early days of this, and the classroom, the
was
project.
Was it taped or live?
It was live.
Wow.
They did tape it while we were broadcasting, but they didn't have enough money in the grant to rent studio time for the taping and then rent time for the broadcasting.
Right.
And so as an economy thing, we had to broadcast it while we were taping. And I got to write all my own lessons, and I made most of my own props by myself. We did have some help with that, but it was really fun, and the kids loved it. And their math scores that year were hugely better than anybody else's.
Well, I suppose they watched the show. I mean, they knew what the teachers
knew. Oh, they
knew.
Did. Oh, they did. Yeah. And sometimes, one time I had taped one in advance for some reason that they let me. And so during the broadcast, I got to sit in the back of a classroom and watch the children watching me. And they were really into it.
Uh-huh.
I had a technique of asking a question, and I looked right at the camera, so the kids, I was looking right at them.
Right.
And then pause a little bit and then give the answer. So when I did that in this lesson, I gave the answer after a pause, and a little girl jumped up indignantly and looking at the television said, "Mrs. Parr, I told you that."
Like they were actually, you're in the room.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, television was fairly new then.
Well, that must have gotten the new math off to a good start.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the school board canceled the program because it was a new thing and they didn't like new things. They thought it was unnecessary.
You mean the new math
curriculum? No, the television.
The television
part. Idea of teaching by television. There were other classes too besides mine.
Oh, I remember educational television back in, you know, when I was a kid. That was a big deal. But you don't see... You
was that
see,
here?
No, just around the country.
Around the country, yeah.
That was kind of a thing back then. And I think it's kind of gone by the wayside.
Well, now they have video. And right? They have... they're making very good use of video. They've got a lot of online courses. And
sure.
you can access a short video lesson on any detail that you need.
Mm-hmm.
Things like YouTube and just... online videos.
Yeah.
So that's the real, because the thing about broadcasting is you're on a set schedule and not everybody's ready at the right time.
Right, right.
So this makes it very, very useful.
Learn at your own speed. That's the new thing.
Yeah.
Pretty neat.
Yeah. The other thing that I did that was so much fun was later on I got to know computers from a job I had with the Department of Education when I went to Juneau with Charlie. And they were introducing computers in the bush. And so I learned how to use the Apple II computer, and I wrote manuals for teachers on how to use it. And I also got to travel around the villages, bringing them a gift of 2 computers per village and teaching them how to use it. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Great way to know the state, too. I mean, what an opportunity.
Yes, yeah, I got to go to quite a few villages.
Mm-hmm. Real opportunity.
So that's the warm feelings about my job, some of them. My fondest memories, is that where we are
yeah.
now? really is of living with Charlie, my marriage to Charlie. We were very compatible. Mm-hmm. And we traveled together. We built a house together. We finished raising those kids together. Mm-hmm. And had a lot of fun together.
Well, what I know of him is being a great man. So after we turn this off, we'll talk about him a little bit. Is there anything you want to say about your marriage or any particular memory about your life together?
There were so many things that were really just right about it. Charlie was older than I was, and the only bad thing about that was that he died much before I did. He died in 2000, and 18 years later, I'm still healthy.
Yeah, that's a long time.
Yeah.
Well, this is a big question. Can you tell us about how you came to be at Raymond's Landing?
Yes, well, Charlie had been dead about a couple of years, and I'd been thinking about my future. We had built like so many Fairbanksons, mm-hmm. we built our dream house out in the hills.
Right.
Way away, and on a steep driveway, mm-hmm. And it was wonderful. But I found that living without him, it was not as much fun as it had been. I was okay. I was able to handle. I had done the plumbing and the wiring mm-hmm. in the house, and so I knew how those things worked, and mm-hmm. I could fix them. Mm-hmm. We put the roof on ourselves, so I could fix roofs. But it just wasn't the fun it was with Charlie there. And I'd been thinking about the Pioneer Home, but I realized that it had changed since the time I first knew about it, as now mostly assisted living, and it used to be mostly independent living, and the going over there and visiting with the pioneers was really interesting, and not so interesting now that so many have dementia. And so began to think about our future, and my future, and my friend's future, who were a lot of them in the same boat, widowed, but still active. Tried to find a home for a friend of mine, another teacher friend of mine. And that was when I realized, when I took her around to the various places in Fairbanks that we thought of, that all of the senior housing in Fairbanks was for low income. And those of us with a pension were not allowed to live there. So she had to settle for a little apartment, but it was very lonely for her. Mm-hmm. And she had to have a lot of help, so she had to hire people to come in and do everything that she needed. So another friend and I, another retired teacher, Marianne Eininger, and I were good friends. We were having lunch one day and talking about this problem, and we decided that what we would really like to have would be to have an apartment in a community of seniors where we could all help each other. And so we decided, well, let's try to build one.
That was a big dream.
That was about 2002 or 3. And so we began by holding a meeting. I was told some friends of ours we thought would be interested, and we held a meeting. The mayor was Jim Whitaker, and he let us use his conference room. And the response was very enthusiastic. So meeting in his conference room every month, it got to be so many people that they were standing along the wall and sitting on the floor, and so noisy with all the wisecracks and the laughing that we were disrupting his staff. We moved to the assembly chambers. And then we rented an office in the Lathrop building and had our meetings there. And with the monthly meetings went on for 10 years. We used them throughout the design of the whole property. We would explain to this, and everybody was invited. There were public meetings. And we would tell them where we were with the process, and then we would solicit ideas from them. Or we would tell them about a particular problem that we were working on, and they would brainstorm ideas. That's where the name came from, Raven Landing, from a brainstorming, and where they voted. That one won. That's where our pet policy came from. We started off with half people wanting pets and half people wanting no pets. We came up with a compromise. It was a very useful meeting. We called it the advisory group.
That's wonderful to get the input of people who are going to really live there.
And I went around particularly, and to some extent, some of the others, and made speeches all over. Anybody who'd mm-hmm. listen to us, to try to solicit local support. And we did get quite a lot of support from places like the Rotary Club and the Lions Clubs. And of course, we were 4 years in a row, I lobbied the legislature for help. But the hardest part was finding a site. This was our first choice. This is Brian Rogers' suggestion, by the way, where mm-hmm. Fairview Manor used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that would be an excellent place right in the middle of town. And it was about the right size. We figured we needed about 5 acres. And the way we knew that was that very early on, we contacted C.B. Bettisworth and he got excited about the project. And he, at no cost to us, because we didn't have any money,
mm-hmm.
we were just going on donations. He designed a prototype plan and figured for the number of spaces we thought we'd need about 5 acres. Turned out to be a very good guess. And it was suggested by a lot of people that we should get cheaper land out in Fox maybe or near Esther or near North Pole. And we didn't want to because we wanted to be in the middle of things. And we wanted our friends and family we wanted it to be very easy for them to come visit and easy for them to pick us up and take us somewhere and bring us back home again.
It's the perfect location.
Yes.
It's perfect.
And if we were out in Fox, you wouldn't want to do that all that often.
Like this.
Come get us in Fox, take us to a play downtown, take us back to Fox again. That gets to be a big project.
Mm-hmm.
So it has turned out to be very good.
Across from the library, it's perfect too.
Yeah, exactly.
It's, you know, it's just cool.
Two swimming pools, the movie theater, a bowling alley, all in the immediate area.
Yeah, I saw you walking. Probably from Mary Sire or somewhere the other day in the snow. I don't know where you're coming back from.
My accountant is over there. My tax accountant.
Oh, she's hardy in the snow, I thought to myself.
Well, it's important to keep moving. We did a lot of research on places like this. Both Mary Ann's parents and mine had been in similar places. Went to Tim Cerny of Fountainhead mm-hmm. for advice. He said, it would never work because he said several companies had looked at this Fairbanks market and decided they couldn't make a profit here because the costs are so high that they would have to charge more than people would pay. But that's why we decided to do a nonprofit. If you eliminate that sector, you don't have to make a profit. You could make it less expensive. So we decided to become a nonprofit corporation. Which happened in 2004. And we picked a very good board of directors. We picked our board of directors very carefully, and it's been excellent. Five of the same people are still on it after all these years.
That's fabulous.
And we still have an excellent board. These are experienced, skilled people mm-hmm. who are dedicated to this. They don't get paid a nickel. Everything's volunteer.
Believe in the project.
Yeah,
you know.
Exactly. So getting the land, though, turned out to be a long, drawn-out thing and too much detail for this interview. But the way it was finally done was that C.B. Bettisworth, the architect, formed a collaboration with a developer in Anchorage, two people who were into funding this kind of project. So with the four entities and an LLC, and they applied and got a federal grant for mitigation of this neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
It was $5 million.
Wow.
And that enabled them to get this guy to finally sell his rights to the property. The property was owned by the city, but it had a sweetheart lease.
Oh, boy.
$1,500 a year for 15 years.
Wow.
No, not 15. 30.
How far along were they in the lease?
There's still 18 years left in the lease. So he owned the buildings, and he owned this lease. It was very hard to get him to sell. He finally did. And they finally made a deal. Then we had to get the city to sell us the property after that. And that was another difficult thing. There were people in the city who didn't agree with what we were doing. But most of them did, and we finally were able to purchase the land. And what was the other big... Oh, at that point, then the developers applied with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation didn't really think it would succeed either. We just kept after them. We wanted at least 95 apartments, because with Jim Cerny's guidance, we figured that would take about that many to be able to afford a kitchen.
Mm.
And the things that seniors most needed when they're old and alone is social life and somebody looking out in case something happens, and food,
mm-hmm.
nutritious food. They generally don't eat right. And so we figured we had to have meals, both for social and nutritional reasons. But you have to have a certain quantity in order to be able to afford that, hire a cook and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So HFC finally agreed to give us money for 20 units, not 95. That was their absolute maximum, because they didn't think we were going to succeed. And so we said, okay, we'll take what we can get. And we built this building.
Number one.
And of course, it filled up immediately, including me.
Mm-hmm.
We found Susan for a director. She had the right kind of experience for this, and she immediately took hold of the reins and steered it to very, very good management. And we were obviously successful. So then they gave us another 20-unit building and another.
Mm-hmm.
And after three of them, we were, at this point, thought we were ready for our community center. Another one of the strictures we had was that they were operating by federal rules, HUD rules. They didn't have to, but they had decided to in administering this money. And so therefore, there would be no dining room in any of their buildings. Their dining rooms were prohibited from a HUD building, I guess because they had, it's such an easy way to lose money and go broke.
Sure.
And so we figured we'd have to have a community building with a dining room in it, and it had to be connected by indoor corridors like the hospital units are, because of the climate and people in wheelchairs and so on. And so CB and his crew, Christoph Falk, by the way, was the chief architect, designed a series of buildings clustered around a community center. But the HFC couldn't finance a community center. That's not their thing. They finance housing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we had to go to the legislature. And we prepared fancy brochures and fancy presentations. And I went down 4 years in a row and talked to everybody, every legislator who would listen to me for 5 minutes. Most of our local delegation were very receptive. Some were not. Some of the Republicans were not. But all of the Democratic ones were. And eventually, the fourth year I got a small grant to start the community center. And then the next year I didn't go down, and they gave us the rest of the money to finish it. maybe to get rid of me.
Finally made that impact. You know, 4 years.
Not again. Not again. Here's your money. Here's your money. Take it. It was quite a bit. The first grant was about $800,000, and the second grant was over $2 million. And that was enough to finish the building with a little help here and there. Mm-hmm. Rasmussen Foundation was a huge help. They financed that first-rate kitchen. It's a four-star kitchen, mm-hmm. all stainless steel, mm-hmm. and very compact and beautifully designed. And so we got our community center, and we also figured, and I got this from visiting the Senior Center in Anchorage. Senior Center in Anchorage makes part of its budget by doing a little catering. They pack lunches. They don't have a dining room like we do, but they pack lunches for a meeting. They take mm-hmm. cater conventions wanting a box lunch or something. So we copied that idea and figured that if we did catering here, we could make up part of our budget, because the Anchorage Senior Center is funded partly by this Anchorage Assembly. And I knew good and well that neither the City of Fairbanks nor the Borough Assembly was going to give us any money to operate on. We are really on our own. Mm-hmm. We used government money to get the buildings up.
But from now on,
it's up to us, and we, of course, have to pay the mortgages on all the buildings mm-hmm. out of our proceeds. And, you know, operations really are expensive here. I was dumbfounded by the utility bills of that community center. They're all kept separately. Mm-hmm. You know, each building has its own budget. Mm-hmm. And it's really expensive to heat that building. And the water bill is high. Mm-hmm. And electricity bill is high. Mm-hmm. But this way, we're making enough money on the catering so that we don't have to raise our fees to the residents anymore. We raised them $100 when we got the center mm-hmm. to help run that center, when we went from 2 meals a week to 6 meals a week. But we don't want to raise them any more than that,
right?
Because this is some people in town have the idea this is a haven for the rich, but it is not. There are people living here who can just barely afford it. And it is cheaper than keeping your own house, generally speaking, mm-hmm. unless your house was very tiny and paid for.
Right.
It's cheaper than operating a house. So very ordinary people, financially speaking, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. can live here, and we want to keep it that way.
Yes, that's a community service right there. That's
yeah.
amazing.
Well, yeah, because, and as we hoped, many people who used to live here are now moving back mm-hmm. to be near their grandchildren, mm-hmm. and they'd moved away because there was no sheltered place in Fairbanks for them mm-hmm. when they got older.
Yep, I know.
But now that there is, they're coming back to Fairbanks.
If they can get an apartment, huh?
Well, yeah. Yeah, the turnover has been more than I guessed at, but I had no experience with this.
Sure.
And it's natural. After all, this is where we're spending the end of our lives, and of course the lives do end.
And things happen along the way. It's,
yes,
it's,
indeed.
It's a very busy time of life. People don't realize.
Yeah.
A lot happens in.
Yeah, you really early on, one lady got out of her car. She was walking, and she just slipped, broken hip, laid up for months.
I know all about it.
You do.
I do. And it's just, you know, people underestimate what happens, you know, in later life and the needs that people have and how dynamic is a very dynamic time
That's,
of life.
Exactly. You're right.
And people just, you know, they don't realize.
The hardest is that the mind deteriorates mm-hmm. For some people pretty quickly and
right.
others not so much so. But when you get to the point where you really cannot take care of yourself anymore, that's a really
that's
tough time.
It is a very, very tough time.
Because all of us hope that we can stay right here the rest of our lives and die right here at home.
Not everybody gets that.
They don't all get to.
No.
But Many of us have already achieved that.
Yes, that's the ideal.
We all hope.
Yes. Well, I guess that kind of comes to kind of our last question. You've told us about how this all started and your role and how it happened, but how do you feel about being here now that you've lived here a while, and how does it feel? And
I feel grateful. Very grateful. It has turned out way better than we imagined,
yeah,
even. We had a glorious, rosy dream, but it's even better than that.
That's a great answer. I like that. You're very grateful. I'm grateful for Raven's Landing, and I don't live here.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm coming to a lecture here tonight. So,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I spend a lot of time here. It's been a wonderful addition to the community, that just to have that meeting space.
Turns out it has.
It has.
And that whole public access was because we had to do it. We had to have a building that the whole public would use, or else the legislature wouldn't have given us the money to build it, just for a handful of seniors.
Sure.
But it is actually a community resource.
It's an amazing community resource.
And the architect was so talented, is so talented. It's just a beautiful building.
It's beautiful. And it's...
And practical.
Functional, yeah.
Very functional.
Yeah, a lot can happen in those... In your community center down there, a lot does happen.
Yeah.
Of music and,
yeah,
and a lot of education. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
So, a fun and final question. What is or was your favorite age and why?
Oh, that's hard.
I know that's hard.
I suppose my favorite age is probably around late middle age to early old age, so around the 50s to 60s, because by that time I had more confidence and I had so much support from my husband. When I was young, I was fairly competent but not confident.
Mm.
And I guess it was a matter of getting along with others, mostly thinking of other people better and not being quite so full of myself. And that's always been a problem for me, and always thought I was right about everything, and that doesn't go over well with other people. And then having my first marriage fail, I felt really very, very incompetent at that point. But Charlie always believed in me and always encouraged me. And by after living with him for 20 or 25 years or so, I began to finally feel confident.
And to believe it.
Yes, and to believe it. So those were kind of golden years.
Well, that's a really interesting answer. A lot of people do say that it's that time of their life where everything's kind of come together. So
yeah.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
You know, you always think it's when you're 19, but it doesn't sound like it really is. It's a little later in life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I should mention one other phase of my life, maybe a couple of others that haven't come up, but people always do ask me about it. They ask about the store we had. In 1976, I had left the school district for a while, and to take a job with town on Chiefs Conference, and that job evaporated. There was some shenanigans, and they'd lost all the money. I was supposed to run a land claims college, which was a great idea, but the money had been squandered before I even got there, and the bookkeeping was so inadequate that they didn't know it. So that job went away. So there I was, not with the school district anymore, and that job was gone. And just at that point, Claire Fesch, who owned the Alaska House, approached me and said she wanted to sell the business and thought I should buy it. So Charlie and I looked it over and talked to them, and we did buy it. Not the building, but the business. So for 23 years, Charlie and I ran that store.
I didn't know that.
Whoever was available. When he was in Juneau, I'd run it. And when I wasn't available, he'd run it. We did different things after that. And the second part of it, we never were much business people, but we had a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. It was really fun. Worked hard. Never earned a whole lot of money. Hardly any. But the other thing that people mentioned that should be mentioned, I guess, if this is supposed to summarize my life, is political activity. Again, this is Charlie's nudging. He wanted me to run for the assembly after he had done this. And he, then he went on to the legislature, but he kept nudging me. Hey, come on, you can do it. Come on. So I did, finally, and won. And that's another long story we don't have time for now. But I did win, and then I was there for one term, and then I went to Juneau to be with him because he was about to quit. He didn't like living alone. Mm-hmm. In those days, the sessions were 5 months long. Oh,
that's a long time to be without your
And we didn't have the spouse. Money to fly back and forth like some of them. Mm-hmm. But then later on, I ran again. Nancy Jones asked me to apply to take her place when she left to become permanent fund dividend director. And I did, and then I ran for the assembly that fall, and I was elected for two more terms. And during those times, I also ran for the legislature twice, but kind of hopeless races. Mm-hmm. Ran against Jean Theriault.
No.
Back when Chena Hot Springs Road had been thrown in with North Pole.
Oh.
So it was mostly North Pole
yes.
voters. And I knew from the start sure. that was hopeless, but mm-hmm. I just didn't think he should get in without any opposition at all. The second time I ran against the dentist, Dr. Fate,
oh.
Dr. Hugh Fate. And I did better that time, but I didn't win. So that's my political career.
So did you enjoy politics?
I did.
Yeah.
Once again, we had a lot of fun. We made unusual floats for the Golden Days Parade at any campaign year.
Uh-huh.
And some of them were more successful than others, but they were always different. My personal favorite, was I don't know if you remember, Charlie used to wear an Uncle Sam hat.
Uh-huh, I do.
As a campaign thing.
Yeah.
So one year we built a gigantic papier-mâché Uncle Sam hat
uh-huh.
right on top of my Volkswagen Bug, resting on the fenders, on the bumpers, resting uh-huh. on the bumpers. And it looked pretty good. And it was so low to the ground, we cut a window out front so that I could see to drive. And I drove that down the parade. It looked like this hat rolling... moving down the street all by itself.
Were you both in there? Did Charlie?
No, Charlie walked.
He walked at the
yeah.
parade.
I have a picture. In fact, I think I have one right.
Oh,
I'll
yeah.
show it to you.
When
after
we're done here, I'd
yeah.
love to see that. So.
Yeah, he walked outside and waved to people, and some people yelled, "Hi, Karen," because they knew good and well who was driving.
It was your car. Well, if you don't have anything else, that might be a real fun place to stop.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much for your time. It was a wonderful interview, and I really feel grateful
thank
to
you.
Get to.
So how far
you,
did I run over?
Oh, we have no limit, so we're right at an hour. It's just
okay.
perfect, and I'll go ahead and turn it off.